And for those of you, I do see some familiar faces. Welcome back, those that we saw back in February in Bangor. What I would say is it's not a lot of new material that I'm going to present here, so you just get a different viewing, certainly a lot better screens here. We also took note of some of your questions last time around, and I tried to incorporate hopefully a few of the answers and address those as we go forward here. So as Barbara said, I'm moving on to part two, which was the tracking and planning the disposal, the proposed disposal of material in the Penobscot Bay. But before I get into that, I want to give a little bit of background about dredging and how we manage disposal, because that has changed a lot over the years, and give you a little bit of background about how we monitor and manage our operations before we actually get into the specifics and talk about the Penobscot site, so that we're all really on the same level before we get there. So if we step back a bit and we look at dredges of old, in the top picture, this is a dredge from the turn of the century, one of the early patent drawings. And I'm going to stand back here so I can move my mouse around and hopefully show you some things. They look very similar. You've got a business end, the bucket over here, attached to a crane, which sits on a barge. It's got a series of uprights or spuds which hold the barge in place. And the one down below is a dredge that was just used a few years ago, I think up here in Maine. So they look very similar. But what has changed is how we manage that operation from project to project. So we go back a little bit and we look about, you know, what did we do with the material early on? And this is a shot from Boston Harbor back in the late 1800s, I believe. And in those early days, really what dredging amounted to was just get the material out of the spot where you are, you know, which might mean just pushing it to the end of your berth area, your wharf, maybe moving it across the harbor to another site, but really not moving it very far. But as sort of the ability to mechanize and move material advanced, we started to see material, dredge material, being moved much greater distances. And if you look up and down our coastline, we have so many ports. What you'll see is a band that almost anywhere in that band along the coastline, you can probably find some relics of historic dredge material disposal. And that went on through the early 1900s, really without a lot of control on it. But as we got to the mid-1900s, we began to see sort of dedicated sites that were set up, typically by the states, because a lot of types of material was going out there, and there was a concern about that. So they wanted to at least have some record as to where it went. But what there wasn't a lot of control over was what went out there. And I'm sure, especially those of you who fish, you know, you've come up with. There are munitions, there's construction waste, there was hazardous waste. Even in some areas, there was low-level radioactive waste, which was disposed off the New England coastline. And that continued on, really, until we got to the late 60s and the 70s with a couple of major pieces of legislation, the Clean Water Act, and the Marine Protection Research and Sanctuaries Act. And that instituted a very rigorous process for selecting and designating dredge material disposal sites. So what you see here is a shot of your coastline, Maine, a series of circles. The red circles are what I would term regional sites. Those are sites that often that have been in place for a while and received dredge material from more than one project, typically. We've got Cape Arundel, Portland, and the Rockland site here at the mouth of Penobscot Bay. The yellow circles are a series of smaller, less frequently used, typically just for one project sites that again extend all the way to very down East Maine. In addition to passing sort of guidelines as to how we sited dredge material disposal sites, those pieces of legislation also put controls as to what type of material could go out there, both in terms of the chemistry, what sort of chemical testing you had to do, but physically as well, because we want to make sure that you're matching the material with the site where you're going to place it. And so, again, those all sort of blossomed in the late 60s and the early 70s. And the program that I represent today, that Larry had introduced, the Disposal Area Monitoring System, really got its start back in 1977, and that was focused on one particular project. It was doing the maintenance and improvement dredging for the Trident class of submarines down in Connecticut. And as you can expect, this area had been a shipyard for, you know, really more than a century, so there were some concerns about it. That material was placed out in Long Island Sound, and because of those concerns, this monitoring program, which was born to very tightly monitor where the material went, how the area recovered afterwards, and see if we were okay with the environmental impacts associated with it. So related to that program were things like targeted placement. As you can see down here in the lower right is a buoy. We started putting marker buoys to make sure that we knew exactly where the material was going to be placed. We started monitoring the recovery of sites after the material was placed there. And we began to summarize that our results in a series of reports. And over in the back corner, if folks didn't see it, we've got some CDs with some of those reports, and also the websites that Barbara had given you, and which will be in this presentation as well, show a link to a website that you can download any of these reports going back now almost 40 years. Where we've gone repetitively to various sites, some of them up here in Maine. And so we've gathered information so that when we come to a project such as Searsport, and Barbara comes to me and we start talking about where could we potentially put this material, our goal is to sort of build on that knowledge, not to just look at this site fresh again. And so we looked at these three potential disposal sites. What was called the older Belfast Bay or Steele's Ledge site up to the north, the closest to Searsport, the Penobscot Bay site, which Barbara had mentioned, and then the Rockland site out near the mouth of the bay. So before we get into talking about that, just a little bit more background about what we do to manage and monitor. And this is a scow load of probably about 3,000 cubic yards of material that came out of Boston Harbor. It was towed offshore, and the split hold scow you see in the middle of the slide splits open, the material falls out, the scow's empty, out of the disposal site. And I can tell you, because I was involved in this project, folks in Boston had concerns, just as they do in Long Island Sound, just as they do, as you folks do up here. And generally, they're fairly consistent, the types of concerns that you would have related to any project. One, can that material be accurately placed? You say you're going to put it at point A. I want to make sure that it actually goes there. And if you get it there, are we confident that it's going to remain there over time with tides and storms and that sort? And will there be an unacceptable release of the material to the water column as it falls through the water column? And then what happens to that benthic system on the bottom as that material impacts it and now you've introduced some new material there? And then you've often got site-specific concerns, which Barbara had also mentioned, the lobster and the mercury, which are here. So I'm going to try to check through each one of those item by item and give you, again, a little bit more background. The first is related to the accurate placement of dredge material. As I said early on, folks just had a target. You know, you go out of the harbor and you go 10 miles out and you drop it. But as the controls started to come into place, we moved from having target buoys to now having very much a dedicated electronic tracking system to make sure that every load of material we know sort of where it's going. And so here's an aerial view of a scow on the left, which is probably about a 3,000-yard scow. And then over on the right is a blow-up of what's the back end, the stern of that scow looks like. And what we've got here, most importantly, is a GPS sensor. We've got a sensor which tells us when that scow is open or closed. We've got draft sensors, so it's measuring how deep the scow is sitting in the water, both fore and the aft, so we can tell whether it's loaded, when it's lost its material. And then it's got a data logger for keeping track of all that information. So basically, what it gives us is a track of the entire picture of a scow from when it's loaded to the dredge all the way out to the disposal site and then coming back in again. And so here's an example of one of those records for a scow which went out of Boston Harbor. Get my mouse here, Boston Harbor, and then it followed its track out to the Mass Bay disposal site, released its material, and then came back in. And on the left are a series of numbers, and this is a sort of information that we can pull off of the system at any point in time. It tells us things like how fast the scout was going, its draft, its heading, were the doors open. And so if we zoom into sort of where the disposal took place, so now we're looking at about a mile stretch of the track of that disposal as it entered the circular Mass Bay disposal site. And we can see exactly where that material was released when the doors opened. And if we're tracking the draft, we could see the scow rise up in the water. And this is really important because even though we have sometimes fairly large disposal sites that might be a mile or two across, like the Mass Bay site, we don't want to spread that material all around. We're, again, very interested in limiting our impact to the bottom, and we're focusing disposal in a given year or given project at a particular point. Just as you can see in the upper diagram here, if we had an area of concern and we wanted to place material off to the side of it, we want to make sure that we've got a record of exactly where that goes. And this is actually one of the projects which is underway related to one of those historic industrial waste sites down in Massachusetts where low-level radioactive waste went, as well as munitions and industrial waste. There are a series of barrels which are in about 300 feet of water, so areas it's been limited in terms of fishing. And our goal is for a very large deep draft project, which is coming up for Boston Harbor, probably about 10 million cubic yards, is to be able to cover that area up so that at some point in time it'll be open for fishing again, and you won't have the concern of dragging and pulling up a barrel or one of these cement casks that has low-level radioactive waste in it. But we don't want to drop that material directly on those barrels, so what we've been working to do is place material off to the side, build up a nice mound, which then sort of spills out laterally and will cover up some of this area. So that's in the works for a few years down the line. And so how do we know, we've done all this planning, we track it, how do we know if we actually did a good job? Well, with the advances in bathymetry, high-end fathometers now, we can go back out and map the seafloor very, very accurately. And this is the exact line that you saw in one of the previous slides that showed the approach track of the scow. And each one of these red circles is about a football field across, and it's the impact of one particular scow load of probably, these were large scows, maybe 3,000 to 5,000 yards of material sort of hitting the bottom in roughly 300 feet of water. And so we were able to measure the offset between what were we aiming for and where did we hit. And you couldn't really hit a dime, but they do really, really well. We're really within a couple hundred feet here. And this was in 300 feet of water in an open ocean setting. The other thing that we've done is we've tracked really well how good of a job we do at a building up a mound of material. As you can see over here in the lower right, you'll see some accentuated sort of highlighted mountainous material. That's where we're trying to drop one load on top of another, see how quickly we can build it up, and can we spread it out laterally, again with the idea of trying to cover up a different area. In terms of tracking the long-term stability of disposal mounds, one of the best examples is to go to Long Island Sound. This is the central Long Island Sound disposal site. This is a rectangular site about 1 mile on one side by 2 miles, a rectangle. And each one of the little clusters that you see there with a name is an individual disposal mound that's probably several football fields in size, might rise 10 to 20 feet off the bottom. And these were particular disposal years or a particular project where we track the material for that year and we go back to it year after year. We've gone back to it after hurricanes, events, you know, there is fishing in the area, and so we track how stable these are in the long run. And all this information that I've been mentioning is in the report. Again, there are some CDs and copies back there if anybody wants to go away with them, and I've made some reference here in terms of the particular reports that you should look to if you're interested in one aspect or another. Let's see, I do have a little bit of a video here to see if this works. So this is a release of about 3,000 cubic yards of material, again out of the Mass Bay disposal site. It happens pretty quickly. Scow splits open along some hinges. Material falls out down the center of, it's probably about a 200 foot long hopper. And in like 15 seconds, it's gone essentially. And I know when I first started working on this, and your intuition is, boy, that's going to make a mess, you know, in terms of all that material falling out, falling through the water column. And there's been a lot of work done to try to assess, you know, what happens there. Not so much related to clean projects like the one here in Searsport, but we've worked, the Corps of Engineers has had to deal with contaminated sediments at a number of sites, and particularly in Boston Harbor and in Providence Harbor, two very large projects, more than 1 million cubic yards of material that was not suitable for open water placement. As Barbara had described for Searsport, all the testing that we'd done, the testing at these sites showed, because of elevated pHs, some metals, that it wasn't suitable to just take it out and release it. You had to do something to manage it better, and that material was put into confined aquatic disposal or CAD cells, like the one shown here, basically a pit which was dug down into the bottom. These were in the channels in both Boston and Providence. The material was released from these split-hulled scows right down over the center of these cells. And again, you can bet there was a lot of concern related to regulators. Was that material going to be released to the water column? What was going to happen when it hit more material down inside the cell? And so associated with that, there was a tremendous amount of monitoring that was required. Lots and lots of testing, lots of going out. And so again, we're trying to build on that experience as we come to you and propose a project. And one of the primary tools that we use is something called an acoustic Doppler current profiler, which is really like a very, very, very high-end fish finder. So it gives you a record of, you strap it onto the size of the boat. We're using a lobster boat actually here. This is in Providence. You get a real-time readout of what the water column looks like. After the scow opens and disposes its load, as soon as it moves out of the way, we would run a pass across where the scow was, and we build a picture, and the colors represent how turbid, how much material is in the water column. So we can see exactly where there's suspended material there, and what we can do is turn around and go, after we run this track, and really only takes 30 to 50 seconds to get across the channel, we come back, we lower a sensor down off the side of the boat, with a tube attached to it, and then we pump a sample. And so now we can get exactly in the spot where we thought it might be worse and send that material off to the lab and do some testing and see, you know, is there an issue associated here? And really, the bottom line is, with all of the testing that was done, there's very, very, very limited impact. And so if here are a series of these transects that we've run across a disposal site, one of these CAD cells, at different times. The first one is about 10 minutes after. You can see a lot of disturbance in the water column. Some of that is suspended material, some of it's bubbles, some of it's eddies in the current. And the second one is 20 minutes, 60 minutes, 70, and by an hour afterwards, we've really gone almost back to normal here. So we see very little plume development, very little transport away from the actual disposal site. And again, that's backed up by a lot of sampling. And looking at the chemistry of the water column. And if you go to the physics folks, and there was a lot of work being done at some of the universities, they'll say, oh, that makes perfect sense. And it didn't to me, but that's just not my background. But when you drop material through the water column, it's very much similar to a thermal, like a rising thunderstorm or a blast, where you don't get material spreading out initially all over the place. You get an initial sort of necking in of that, except that it's in a reverse proportion. So as the material falls out of the scow, it's actually drawing more water in with it, and it doesn't begin to spread out until it gets a lot deeper. And fortunately for us in New England, we don't really have any sites that are of the depth where this material would begin to spread out. And there were a series of lab studies that were done to test that, and this is some poor graduate student at MIT spent, I think, 2 years dropping fluorescent beads in a tank. This is a tank about 15 feet high, and it simulates the release of material from a scow. And you can see initially it just comes down as a very straight slug, and it's not until you get much deeper into the water column where the material begins to spread out and separate. And again, if we go back to our sites, everything that happens on our sites is up here in the top part, where before that material has had a chance to spread out through the water column.
Yeah.
Then we get to assessing the impacts to the venting system on the bottom. And it's clear, I mean, there's really no way around it. If you drop a load of material, several thousand cubic yards of material out of a scow, everything that's in the footprint of where that hits is going to get covered. It's going to get smothered. But I liken it a lot to dropping clean material on a field, in that, you know, you put the material down, you buried the worms, you buried the insects, all that stuff is essentially gone. But literally, within days, you start to see things starting to inhabit the top of it and repopulating it. And there's been a lot of studies here in New England that shows that that follows a very standardized sort of progressive track here. In fine-grained, sort of muddy sediment, in muddy to sandy environments, if you disturb the bottom, then it might be the placement of dredge material, or maybe you drag a net across it, or you anchor a vessel there, whatever, you've done something to disturb it, it comes back relatively quickly. And that's what we do as part of the program that I'm involved in, is that once we place material there, we're going back to it sequentially to make sure that it's come back. Because if, lo and behold, there was some issue associated with the sediment that we didn't catch, we want to make sure that we see that, that if it's not recovering correctly, we're going to do something to correct that. We'll cover it up with additional material. And so how do we assess that? So we use a camera system. That's probably one of our primary tools. This is called a sediment profile image camera. It's shown here on the back of a deck, and it's in that very large frame system here. It's actually two cameras. They get lowered down to the seafloor. So here you see the frame approaching the seafloor. And as it gets just above the bottom in the second image, a light comes on and we take a picture, a plan view image, so we get an image looking down on the bottom. Then the frame actually impacts the bottom, sits there, and a wedge-shaped prism, which is on the very right shown here, actually is pushed down into the sediment, and we get a picture across the sediment water interface. So we get to see the water up above, and we get to see the sediment below. We get a lot of information out of this in terms of how healthy that bottom is. We can see the type of material that's there, the sort of the layering. We can see if it's well oxygenated. If this site has poor oxygen conditions, you can pick it out right away in terms of what the bottom looks like. We could see, are there sort of some of the early populators there? Are there just the small worms and critters which come in soon after it's been disturbed? Or does this have very deep burrows? And this shows that, gosh, this has been undisturbed for quite a while. It's a very healthy environment. And that's really what we've seen. I mean, I say that we go back and check, and we've got countless reports that I can, you know, point you in the direction of at our site. But really, this is a system that's worked, and that we've really not had any failures if we look up and down the coast here. And we know that this system works because the EPA back in Long Island Sound said, we want to test it and we want to make sure. They took some actually very nasty material out of, where was Black Rock Harbor? In Bridgeport, Connecticut, and intentionally placed that in one spot in Long Island Sound, and did not put a cap or a cover over it, and then had us test that. And we just went back year before last, it was after 20 years, to look at it. And initially, you could see some little colonizers come in, and then boom, nothing. You know, it just does not come back, because the sediment clearly shows, you know, the critters know this is not a healthy environment. And so we were able to demonstrate that our system could actually pick that up, and so that we could tell if somehow we had missed the mark and not done a good job in terms of testing the material. So that's sort of all the background that we sort of pulled in together as we started to look at the sites in Penobscot Bay, potentially. Three sites, as I've mentioned: Belfast Bay, which is the furthest north, also sometimes called Steele's Ledge. It shows up on some of the historical charts as a disposal area, but we have no formal record of its use. Since we started tracking projects, we don't have any projects which we have a record of going there. Then we've got the Penobscot Bay site, which Barbara had mentioned, which is a little bit further south in deeper water. We did some sampling there in 2007 and 8, and then we went back again this last summer. And then we've got the Rockland site further south out by the mouth of the bay. So we'll start with Rockland first. It's probably the easiest. It's certainly the furthest. So It's about 38 miles additional haul round trip for every scow load of material that would go from the next closest site, being the Penobscot site. So if you just do the math of a tug, you know, plowing along, pulling his haul, that's about 63 days of tug scow traffic additionally on the bay for this project. It means roughly 260,000 gallons of diesel fuel. It means a lot of additional cost to get the material to long haul, to get it out and back. And that just did not seem feasible for this particular project. We look at the Belfast Bay or Steele's Ledge site. Again, this shows up, it's closer to Searsport. It shows up in an area which historically it had some dredge material disposal, but it's much shallower, about 60 feet. And because of the amount of material coming out of this project, we would have to cover a lot of the sort of the square footage of that site because we can't build it up too high. We can't, you know, we're certainly going to keep navigational depth, even though this isn't in the channel. So we've got to spread the material out over a much larger area just to be able to say we're going to keep it below 45-foot maximum depth. So that seemed a little problematic as well. And that brought us to the third site, which is Penobscot Bay site, we've termed it. Again, we have no record of disposal here, but it shows up historically. And if you zoom in here, you can kind of see the dashed lines on this particular chart that say disposal area. So we know historically at some point in time, Coast Guard put this on the chart because they'd hauled material out here and dropped it. Well, we looked at an area on sort of the southern side of that box. It was in water depths of about 100 to 200 feet. And we did some additional measurements. As Barbara mentioned, we collected some samples there early on, made sure that it was chemically and physically, it matched, it was an okay, it was compatible with the material coming out of Searsport. And then this last year, we went and did sort of some of the same investigations that I just gave you an overview of here. Very detailed mapping. We did that camera, all the various dots on here, we dropped that camera all over the place and got a really sort of good picture of what the bottom looks like. And so here's the bathymetry of that particular footprint and showing in the dashed black line the area that we were targeting potentially for placement of the material. And it's characterized, and you guys that fish the area know, a series of deep pock marks. And because some of these are so deep, we really wouldn't have to spread this material over the whole area. We could really target just a few of them, as shown by the red outlines here. And even though it seems like a tremendous amount of material that's coming out of Searsport, we could really put it in two of these little circles would be enough capacity. In terms of what the bottom looks like, and this is an image from that camera system within one of those pockmark or pits right down in the center of it. You can see a very soft, fine grain environment. This is probably about 2 feet across, this image on the top here. We see some burrows, we see some critters down here. The image on the right is a cross section, again looking across that sediment water interface. Reasonably healthy environment, it's oxygenated. It's, you know, I would say it kind of falls in the middle. It's not like one of those where you say, oh my gosh, this is a wonderful, tremendous ecosystem, but it's not at all devoid of life. And I'm sure there are folks here who probably fish it and find it reasonably productive. Again, there are some burrow holes there as well. But the idea was that we weren't seeing anything that was unique about these. It was similar to a lot of the other sites that we placed material at. We have no reason to believe that if we place some material here, we're clearly going to disturb that actual footprint, but over time it's going to come back pretty quickly. And so here's just an idea about the size of one of those scows. Within the center, the yellow box is roughly the size of a scow over one of those pock marks on the bottom. And again, as I said, between one and two of those sort of clusters of pits would be enough to hold all of the material from this particular project. Now I know you still had some potential concerns, and Barbara had mentioned the mercury, but I wanted to talk a little bit more about it because it's a valid concern. It's a huge study. The study that Barbara mentioned is probably one of the most elaborate mercury studies that I've ever seen in my whole career. They're very, very thorough, and I think it's just the way, I want to say the cards fall, the way that the currents flow is that this particular side of Penobscot Bay ended up much less in terms of an impact from that related to, as opposed to the eastern side of the bay. The red arrow pointing off to the northeast is roughly the location where the source from this Holtrachem facility was. It was the source of the merger, and that spread down. And there, as Barbara had showed, there are just tremendous number of samples that were collected, and we feel very confident in our results because they were supported almost exactly to the same number by what was done by this very extensive, elaborate mercury study as well. And so, fortunately, you know, this area is in an area where the mercury contamination is just not at a level that's going to cause an issue. It's well below the concentration that's going to trigger remediation that's going to be further up in the bay. And there will be. It's clear to me that there will be some dredging. There'll be removal of material. They're not quite sure exactly yet what they're going to do with it, but that's all going to happen further up the river. And I think some of the experience that comes out of potentially this project could be built upon for however they do that later on, what we would call remedial dredging to remove the mercury contaminated sediment. And just a note on suitability testing. Barbara had mentioned, you know, we tested, and that was one of the questions that we got last time around was, you know, how do you do this stuff? What are the rules associated with it? And there are a lot of rules. There's guidance. There are two guidance documents for ocean and inland water testing. They prescribe very detailed way how you collect the samples to be sure that you're getting something that's representative. We don't just go out and get one sample. What do we test for? You know, why do we pick particular contaminants? What sort of background work do we do to look at, were there potential releases of material that might say, gosh, you need to look more in depth at one particular end of a project versus another? And so there's a lot of thought that goes into, and the EPA has to bless that program before we actually go out and do it. Also, addressing the concerns related to lobster, and just a step back to this much larger image, and I've got one up on the wall over here, a full-size chart. Again, we're talking big numbers and, you know, pushing 900,000 cubic yards of material to come out of this project. But when we look at the scale of the upper bay, we're really talking about very small impacts in terms of specific areas. And I know we're going to meet with the Lobstermen's Association coming up in early May, right, Barbara, to talk about specific concerns in the particular areas. But, you know, we're confident that this could be done in a way which really does not impact the fishery in terms of the timing of the year or, you know, where we're actually going. And actually, this is a slide that Kathy had pulled off. This shows a history of lobster landings in Knox and Waldo counties. It's got a few caveats associated with it as to how much was included in some of the early years, but this comes off the state website, essentially. And what you can see is over time, as we go from 1964 up to 2012, where there's a last year with data, you've done really well at managing your resource here lobster-wise. Landings have gone up traditionally here, but there has been dredging that's occurred, I don't want to say every year, but a lot of years over that period. Lots of the harbors have been dredged over that time, mostly going to Rockland, but some of them, as we go back into the 60s, were fairly large projects where you see the red arrows here. Those were projects that were over 100,000 yards. And so I think it's just another piece that we put out there that says, well, they've been compatible in the past in terms of dredging and placement of material, as long as you're doing it correctly. And finally, to summarize a little bit with some of the points that Barbara had mentioned in terms of steps that we would go to that we do on our projects to make sure that we're comfortable with we're limiting the impacts to the water column as well as the biota. So as Barbara had mentioned, strict seasonal windows on when this work would be performed. We have electronic tracking of every scow load of material that goes out. So ultimately, that would all be available to every folks, but that's part of a lot of what I've done over the winter is I look at a lot and a lot of various tracks of scows to make sure that they started in the right place and they ended in the right place. We would do subwater column monitoring, even though we're confident that this is this falls into line with the previous projects that we've done. We do more monitoring here just to confirm it, because we know that there's a lot of concern associated with it. We also do periodic bathymetry to make sure that the material was in the right place. And then we do long-term monitoring to track the recovery of the system over time. And I think that's it. Here's again another information slide. The middle URL there is the program site for all of the various reports. Again, you can download them, or if you've got an interest, because we had a couple of reports which were related directly to, we've done some monitoring related to lobsters over time.